This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Leo Honeycutt, the well-known biographer of four-term governor Edwin Washington Edwards. Leo has some comparisons with Edwin Edwards during his trials and tribulations and those that are now facing Governor Bobby Jindal, who parked his tax plan on the opening day of the session 2 days ago. Is there hope for redemption for Governor Jindal, or is his popularity on a downward slope that cannot be reversed? We'll talk about it with Leo Honeycutt on today's show. Also, Chancellor Freddie Fitcher from the Southern University Law Center, the school that produced D.A. Hiller Moore and Mayor President Kip Holden. Some legacy to talk about with Chancellor Fitcher and what is going on contemporaneously at the Law Center. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Thank you so much for your support over the last few days as we seek contributions to keep the programs going as you know them and love them right here on WRKF. And I hope you enjoy this hour of programming and will show your support for the 9 to 10 hour if you have not done so already. We are joined by Leo Honeycutt, the biographer of Edwin Washington Edwards. We knew him for many years as a prominent morning show host on WBRZ.
And I'm still trying to catch up with my sleep.
He's still got those morning patterns. I saw him at Louis this morning. And Leo, through his research of Governor Edwards, I think has become the foremost living historian of Louisiana political lore.
It's kind of hard to talk to the dead ones.
Well, T. Harry Williams is unavailable, so I asked Leo to be on the show this morning.
And oh, wow.
Edwin Edwards had, I guess, 16 State of the State addresses. That's basically what the opening of the session amounts to. And some of them were notable, and some of them involved some contrition for past sins. And Bobby Jindal gave one of the shortest addresses he's ever given, and perhaps one of the shortest addresses to ever open a session. He addressed only one topic. That was his tax plan, and he says, "I'm parking it." Now, parking is a verb that means a lot of things. What does it mean in this case?
It means he's going to back off of it. He saw the ratings go down for himself. He's down to 38% approval. Of course he's going to back off on it. Besides, it was not a dollar-for-dollar thing. They never could make those numbers work. And raising sales taxes around the state to 13%, do you know what that would do when you went out to purchase a car? You know how much tax you'd be paying to buy a car?
I mean, you're the biographer of Jerry Lane. I would imagine he wasn't all that enthused about this.
Oh, no, I guess not. You know, Jerry's, you know, I think he's pretty much retiring now, and he probably doesn't care. Well, he does care, but it's not going to affect him directly. But nevertheless, it would affect every car dealership throughout the state. Mm-hmm. But let's face it. It's what a lot of people have began to understand as this thing began to unfold. Bobby Jindal's looking for a dramatic turn in the state because only something dramatic is what he's going to be able to talk about should he ever run for the White House. So that's what this is really about. And at the bottom end of it, it's really trying to run off poor people and older people. And a lot of that began to filter through. If you replace income taxes with sales taxes, you're really trying to get the poor people to leave the state. And while I can understand the reasoning behind that, if you look right across the Sabine at Texas did not, they don't have an income tax, but they have a very high property tax, and they've been able to put in an incredible infrastructure in Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, San Antonio, mm-hmm. Austin, through the property tax, not necessarily through the fact that they don't have income taxes.
Well, as the governor addressed lawmakers Monday, there's a nice photo of that in the New York Times yesterday. In fact, many media types also photographed right behind the governor. The governor surprised a few people with his announcement. The headline reads, "A governor retrenches on a big idea. Leader with national profile is battered by setbacks in Louisiana." Let's give a listen, Kevin, to Governor Jindal Monday in an address that was heard right here on WRKF.
I listened to what you had to say, and I listened to what the people of this great state had to say. Now, let me tell you what I heard them tell me. I heard them say, "Governor, we do want to get rid of the income taxes. We think that's great. But we also, we're worried you're moving too quickly. And we're not sure your plan is the best way to do it." I want you to know, first of all, that's certainly not what I wanted to hear But I heard those comments. And so let me do something that politicians don't normally do. I've heard those comments. We're going to adjust our course. I'm telling you today that we're actually going to park our tax plan.
And the governor parked it, whatever that means, and I think we do know what it means. But by parking it, he also called on lawmakers to do the heavy lifting.
Send me that bill. Send me that bill to get rid of those taxes. Send me that bill to make Louisiana the best state in the country to create jobs, to raise a family. Send me that bill. We don't want to just compete. We want to win the contest for new jobs, for new investment, to bring our sons and daughters home. Send me that bill. We must not leave this session without getting that work done.
Well, we live in a state in which we believe in redemption. Edwin Edwards was left for dead politically a few times and came back and won a fourth term after he had been voted out of office in 1987. David Vitter survived a sexual scandal to win going away in a U.S. Senate race in 2008. Now, Leo Honeycutt, is there a way for Governor Jindal to turn this around?
Not in the short term. I don't think so. I think that, I went into the Edwards Project trying to find out if this guy was a crook. If Edwards was a crook. And what I found after 5 years of research and going back and studying all those different legislative sessions, and remember, this is back at a time when Louisiana was actually flush with money. So many people think the politicians pad their pockets. That really doesn't happen. It does in rare cases, but it doesn't really happen. Most politicians that run for office are actually trying to do something good. And I believe that Governor Jindal is doing the same thing. I think he is doing what he thinks is best. Did they rush at it too fast? Yes, absolutely. But in Edwards' case, here's the difference between the two leaders. In Edwards' case, I don't think we had a better administrator of state government than Edwin Edwards, maybe since Huey Long. Huey was on the fast track for the White House, too. But Huey used force to get through everything that he wanted. He was continually calling special sessions. In fact, that's when he was shot. He was shot at a special session in 1935. So in Edwards' case, his brain worked so quickly that he was able to keep everybody focused. Even when E.L. Bubba Henry, good friend, turned against him as a Speaker of the House during the Constitutional Convention in 1973. They got at odds, but they still did the right thing for the state, and they were able to administer state business. State business is so big, it is moves so fast that you don't have time. Like, I love Dave Treen to death, but he just pondered too much. He just spent too much time trying to study every one of those, 3,000 bills a year, and you just don't have that kind of time. Edwards delegated. He delegated and made quick decisions and moved on.
He got somebody else to write his book, too, Honeycutt. It's interesting that he has never written a book, and Bobby Jindal never written a book, but Bobby's only 41 years old, and he's got some time left on the state scene, probably the national scene. Can he come back? I'll give this as an example. In 1980, Bill Clinton was voted out of office in Arkansas at the age of 34. He became the youngest ex-governor in American history after becoming the youngest governor in U.S. history, at least in the 20th century. And he came back 2 years later. Those were two-year terms and won re-election. And he apologized on television for his mistakes. Will we see some mea culpa like that from Governor Jindal?
No. I don't think you ever will, because then that would be turned around against him in some future campaign. And, of course, that's what they're so desperately trying to protect right now, is some other faux pas like he had after trying to do the first rebuttal to the president, President Obama.
Dorothy on Goodwood. Hi, Dorothy.
Good morning. I was wondering if I was hearing stereo Monday, or was I hearing Barack Obama invoked?
What are you talking about?
When he said, send me that bill.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That's true.
That's true. The president took a page out of, or the governor took a page out of the president's playbook. And some would say that Bobby Jindal is no Barack Obama. Obama was elected president twice with more than 51% of the votes each time, 52% each time.
This guy, Bobby Jindal, has a long way to go before he becomes president. But I've remarked on this show once before that when Jimmy Carter announced he was running for president, the Atlanta Constitution ran a bold headline that said, Jimmy Carter is running for what? And he won. Strange things happen in politics, Leo.
Well, they really
do. We could be looking at the next leader of the free world.
That's true.
Right down the street from us.
We could, and we would hope that maybe there'll be some time to mature between now and then.
Well, we'll talk more with Leo Honeycutt, biographer of Edwin Edwards, the best-selling book ever published in Louisiana. And we'll also hear from the Chancellor of the Southern University Law Center, the Honorable Freddie Pitcher. All this, but we pause for a few moments from our good friends at WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. In a bit, we're going to hear from Freddie Pitcher, the chancellor for the last 10 years at the Southern University Law Center, celebrating its 65th year of existence. And we're joined for a bit longer by Leo Honeycutt, intrepid journalist and biographer to Edwin Washington Edwards, an opus that was a long time in the works, and what a response. The governor turns 86 on August 7th. Hopefully he'll be with us again around his birthday, as he has been the last few years. How's he doing?
He's doing fine. He's doing fine. They had a little blip in the road last week, but they're doing good.
Well, next week there is a debate in which the governor, Edwards, will be on the same forum with Kathleen Blanco, Buddy Romer, and Mike Foster. And I'm sure much will be said about the current events, including what's going on with Governor Bobby Jindal. And the governor, by virtue of proposing this ambitious plan, Bobby Jindal has been now attacked from the left and the right. Joshua Stockley, a professor of political science at the University of Louisiana at Monroe, before the governor's address Monday, said a funny thing happened to Bobby Jindal on his way to losing his bid for the White House. He ended up with a popularity rating, most recently, 37.8%, over 6 points lower than President Obama, who has run twice in Louisiana after winning landslides nationally. He only got 41% in Louisiana, 40% first time, 41% the second time. The governor, I'm surprised, Leo, and I'm actually pleased, he's not disputing the numbers. Usually they attack the messenger. In this case, it would be Bernie Pinsonat. But the governor has basically said the numbers are right. It's just that people are not ready for change so fast, so swiftly. Is that a valid assessment of what's going on?
Yeah, and I think that shows some character maturity on the part of his staff. I mean, we everybody knows that the staff is very young. And when we are younger, we tend to be idealistic, and we want to push things fast. And at the end of the day, you realize that most people in the state are older than you are, have been around a little bit longer, and also have possibly more compassion. So in this case, you know, you can take almost any example. For instance, after Katrina and they shut down Charity Hospital was renovated and could have been up and running within a year.
Mm-hmm.
But the general administration did not reopen it. Why didn't they do it? Well, the Foundation for Historical Louisiana went down there and paid an outside party engineer to come in and check out Charity to see if it was still viable. And this guy said, not only is it viable, you couldn't rebuild this type building. It was built so well in the 1930s that it was practically not just hurricane-proof, but bomb-proof. So instead, what we did is we started building a half-billion-dollar new charity hospital, which possibly we needed, you know, but still, you could have still worked with the people down in New Orleans that needed the help, but instead they had no place to turn.
Well, sometimes change is difficult. I recall when Edwin Edwards signed off on building the New Orleans arena, people were saying, why do we need a $100 million basketball arena across the street from the Superdome, which is perfectly capable of having any kind of basketball game you want? But that's added a lot of spruce to the downtown area.
Sure,
New Orleans.
Absolutely.
And This hospital will also, if you've been downtown, that's going to be an enormous facility.
An enormous complex, it is.
I think this may actually work out well for the
governor. I'm thinking about the people who can't really get health care. And I mean, you know, and Governor Jindal has turned his back or turned us away from $16 billion in the Medicaid care that would have helped 400,000 people.
Well, that's a whole different issue.
Right.
That's one that, yeah, he's got some questions to answer on that front, and I don't think the majority of the people are with him on his stand, and he has drawn a line in the sand.
Well,
so
and
how,
also that,
how can you get out of this when you've drawn the proverbial line in the sand? How can you say, oh, never mind?
You're hoping that people do forget quickly and voters do forget quickly. I think in Governor Jindal's case, you know, he was, as part of this tax plan, he was going to do away with loopholes. Got to do away with loopholes. But the reality is that he increased loopholes 167% at a cost of $4.4 billion in state revenue.
HB in Denham Springs. Good morning, HB.
Good morning. Mr. Leo, I think that personally that Governor Edwards will go down in history as a person or a politician that you either liked or you disliked. But I think everyone would pretty well agree, regardless of which side that they're on, that he is a man of great intelligence and wit. Your opinion on that, please, sir. Thank you.
Well, you know, that's a given. I don't think we ever had anybody short of Huey Long or maybe Uncle Earl, who is as quick-witted as what Edwin Edwards was. I mean, I told him many times, you know, if, instead of being the governor, if you had just been a stand-up comedian, you could have been a multimillionaire. You could have been bigger than Hope and Seinfeld. And, you know, and he said, well, you know, I probably could have been, but I just felt a calling to try to lead my state into a better life. And a lot of people that are detractors of Edwards say, well, he didn't do that. But the reality is after I went back over all those legislative sessions in his years of actually running the state, he did do a lot of good things. I mean, he parked a lot of money for the future, like the Education Trust Fund. No other state did that. And if it weren't for that, can you imagine the budget cuts right now at higher education?
Well, I mentioned Bill Clinton earlier in some of his early challenges as president of the United States. And remember, his first 2 years, he was pushing health care. And the Republicans gained control of the House and Senate in 1994, just 2 years into the Clinton presidency. And it looked like it was curtains for the man from Arkansas. And he boldly picked up the phone and asked for advice from none other about around 1993, when things were going south, Richard Milhouse Nixon. Now, if Bill Clinton can call Nixon, should Bobby Jindal call Edwards?
Oh, he probably pretty much knows what the answer would be, and I doubt that you'll ever see anything like that. I think that he was even invited to be at the thing at LSU next week you were talking about earlier, you know, with the other four governors, but I doubt that he'll show for that. It would be to his interest to do that, but I doubt that he will.
He would be the star of the show. If he came.
But that would take guts, see?
Well, I think he has guts, but I think he's calculating. He might not see the percentage in being there. And Bobby Jindal is a brilliant guy.
Yes,
and,
he is.
Of the five governors there, if they took an IQ test, he probably would win that. But when you put him up against Edwin Edwards, Edwin is so quick with the quips that I don't know that Governor Jindal could stay up with it.
Well, you know, that was one of the big fears of Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, back in the mid-70s, we were going into the bicentennial election, was really afraid that Edwards would be drafted. And if he was, he was afraid he would be in a debate with him, and he was afraid that if he were, he would lose to Edwards, and he would have.
Mm-hmm.
So he pretty much did everything he could to make sure Edwards didn't come up into the National Democratic Party.
All right. I got an email from Chaz on Jefferson. I don't know if this is the Chaz, but he says Romer would win the win the IQ exam.
Well, that may be true. Buddy Romer is very, very, I mean, Harvard-educated, as we all remember, and is very quick, too. And a lot of his reforms, I was really thought, were very, very good in the late 1980s, early 1990s. But again, Romer could not interface well enough with 144 to make it happen. I mean, it was my way or the highway, you know, similar to another administration I know right now.
Well, that's a good point, is that the governors who've had the most difficulty in recent times, modern times, are those that did not serve in the Louisiana legislature. Most difficulty dealing with the legislature, and that's Jindal and Treen and Romer. The ones who were there before, like Blanco and Foster, and Edwards, mm-hmm. they knew, I think, a little more about what they were getting into.
Well, I think so, too. I think that, but Governor Edwards just naturally has, Edwin Edwards just naturally has this ability to be able to work with people and not hold a grudge. There was one thing I learned after these 5 years of interviews with him is that he has lived as long and as well and successfully as he has because of three things. He never smoked, he never drank, and he never held a grudge. Even in politics, and that's extremely hard to do.
I think he held a grudge against Frank Palazzolo.
Well, I think he probably would have, wouldn't you? I mean, if you look at the investigation and trial chapter of the book, that's not hard to understand.
Well, let's just take whether Palazzolo was right or Edwards was right out of it. Yeah, I would hold a grudge against the guy who was responsible for me spending 8.5 years in jail. I'd rather he was right or wrong, but...
It didn't eat at him.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Okay.
I mean, he'll be 86 on August the 7th, and he's having a baby.
Here it is. Here's an email, as we close with Leo, from CJ saying, I cannot believe I'm sitting here listening to you and Leo Honeycutt discuss how wonderful Edwin Edwards was. Second only to Huey Long. Edwards was an unmitigated disaster for this state. He was a populist demagogue who built on Huey Long's legacy and enhanced the state at the expense of the citizens. Your response, Leo Honeycutt.
Well, you know, and I can understand that side of it because I used to feel the same way. But I did the research, put it together, 1,736 footnotes, and, you know, in case you don't believe me, the research is all there. I do still think that he is one of the best, if not the best, state administrator of state business that we probably have ever had.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Leo Honeycutt. And we're joined now by His Honor, former judge, Freddie Pitcher. And when I say former judge, he's been a judge at City Court, District Court, Appeals Court, and the Supreme Court. And he is the chancellor of the Southern University Law Center, has been for the last 10 years. And this is a big week for the Southern Law Center, its 65th anniversary. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm sure you've got some events to commemorate this time.
Quite a few things going on. 65 years ago, Charles Hatfield, a returning serviceman from World War II, filed a lawsuit to enter LSU, and as a result of that lawsuit, Southern was founded in January of 1947. $40,000 was appropriated to open our law school, and we've been in operation now for the last 65 years.
How did the $40,000 appropriation come about in 1947?
It came about as a result of the lawsuit because of this Southern Dean Hebert actually wrote Hatfield a letter and said LSU did not accept colored persons to LSU Law School. And he needed to go to Southern for legal training. The lawsuit resulted in the Louisiana Board of Education, along with the Louisiana State Department of Education, coming together and appropriating this, having the legislature to appropriate this money mm-hmm. in order to start a law school. This was a Plessy versus Ferguson type settlement, separate but equal. And but today we are no longer a Plessy school. We're a Fordyce school. We're proud of where we are and what we've accomplished.
Right. Well, we think in 1947, that was a year before Louisiana voted for Strom Thurmond for president, giving its electoral votes to a man whose one issue was segregation. Strom Thurmond, the then governor of South Carolina. And that was 1947. 65 years later, the Southern Law Center is the most integrated university setting in Louisiana, isn't
we,
it?
Not only in Louisiana, Jim, but in the country. We have consistently been cited by the U.S. News and World Report, as well as like the Princeton Review, as being one of the most diverse law schools in the country, not only with regards to our student population, but also with regards to our faculty. So we are,
the
proud
student body is about half white, half black, isn't it?
It's pretty close to being 50-50, yes.
And there's no place like that, as you say, in the United States.
Hardly.
I don't know of any school in the United States in higher education that's half white and half black, other than the Southern Law Center.
It's vacillated between 60-40, but right now we're about 55 45 in the ratio.
55
African-American, 45, yeah.
And the faculty is?
The faculty, at least 35% of our faculty, Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's interesting that LSU had a report that was in the Reveille a few weeks ago showing that only 52 professors at Louisiana State University are African-American. 52. There are more African-Americans on the football team than there are teaching at the flagship university in Louisiana. We still have a ways to go as far as enlightenment in this state on that front, but the Southern Law Center has been a beacon for change.
We have really, since our inception, notwithstanding the fact that we were a Plessy school, our doors have been open. Early on, when I started law school in 1970, my first year at Southern, we had several Caucasian law students enrolled at Southern at that time, which was, you know, quite revolutionary for Louisiana. But since that time, of our nearly 4,000 graduates, nearly one-third of all of our graduates are white.
We'll return with Chancellor Freddie Pitcher of the Southern University Law Center after this time out on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Freddie Pitcher, the Chancellor at Southern University's Law Center, is with us, celebrating 65 years in existence, started in 1947 as a result of segregation at Louisiana State University. Now Southern University's Law School is regarded as one of the bright lights in Louisiana as far as change, with a student body that's almost half black, half white. And 705 students who go there, and it includes an evening program, something that has come about under the leadership of Chancellor Pitcher. That's something that enables people like Mike Foster, the former governor, who was doing a day job that involved being the chief executive of the state of Louisiana, to go to college. But he didn't even have the day program, did he? He was taking regular courses during working hours, wasn't he?
Absolutely. The governor actually started our part-time day program. Vicki Agnihotri was the chancellor of the law school at the time, and the governor made application, and Chancellor Agnihotri saw fit to create a part-time evening program, and the governor was able to take advantage of it.
And he graduated. It took a while because he was a part-time student, but he stayed the course. He did so after he was 70 years old, and it shows a quest for learning that I think is the reason why Mike Foster, who will be 83 in a couple of months, is still sharp as a tack at his age. He has a curiosity that was evidenced by being a student at the Law Center when he was governor, and I hear he was a pretty good student.
Jim, when I was very impressed with the governor, even after he left office, he still had about a year left on his degree, and he came to law school dressed out some days in blue jeans, but he had a study group that he met with, young, bright students who sat with him. He sat in the atrium just like the regular students and engaged in conversation and dialogue about the law with those students. And I think, you know, that kind of give and take, you know, with, you know, young, inquisitive minds helped to keep him, you know, as sharp as he still is. Mm-hmm.
Now, I've seen those students with those big books. They're about as big as John Foles's cooking books. And when you're carrying three or four of them, you got about 40 pounds of books in your hand. Did the governor have a special parking place, or did he have to lug those books across campus?
Jim, I had to make some special dispensation for the governor. one day I saw him lugging across the parking lot, and he was, you know, barely making it. So I told the governor, I said, look, you know, here's the I made a creative parking spot for him up close to the building. I thought his service to the state, he deserved that.
I'm sure he appreciated that. Did he ever ride his motorcycle to campus?
No, I never saw the motorcycle.
Well, he is an example of a famous person, and a successful individual who went to Southern's Law Center, as did the DA, Hiller Moore, as did the mayor, Kip Holden. You have quite an impressive alumni.
Jim, we are quite pleased at the success of Southern law graduates, not only in the state of Louisiana, but all over the country. Our alums have really distinguished themselves. For instance, we have an alumni discussion, a panel discussion for our students, and the featured speaker during that program is Clara Babineau-Fontenot, who's the Senior Vice President and Chief Tax Officer of Walmart International. This is, you know, quite an achievement for a Southern alum. Also, one of the at our Hall of Fame banquet on Saturday night, Monica Azar, a 1994 graduate, will be honored. She is the Vice President and Deputy General Counsel for Verizon. She's over the video and advocacy aspect of this, you know, huge mm-hmm. company. And we have other alums, you know, who are really being gaining, you know, great position in various companies around the country.
That's fantastic. For those who'd like more information about this weekend's events, what's the best way to find out?
You can go online at www.sulc.edu and pull up our website, and all of the events, the alumni roundup weekend events are all there. Just like I indicated tonight, we have the alumni panel discussion for our students. On tomorrow, we will have an all-day CLE program for practicing in state and federal courts. Tomorrow afternoon, well, evening, we will have seven judges who will be mm-hmm. have their portraits unveiled. These will be seven of some 80 judges who are Southern graduates from all over the state and nation. We created this judicial wall of fame at the Law Center, and we have one federal judge, five Louisiana state judges, and one judge wow. From Florida who will have their portraits unveiled. And then we have a distinguished alumni reception on Thursday evening where we have six persons who will recognize for their achievements mm-hmm. and accomplishments in the law. Then Friday, a chancellor scramble at Copper Mill, which will be fun. And
you're going to be busy.
All this is about, you know, not only about our connecting back with our alumni, but we're also using this to raise money. You know, as you know, with budget cuts.
Well, yeah, how have the budget cuts affected you?
The budget cuts have kind of been somewhat debilitating to the extent whereby all we can do is hold serve, meaning that replacing state dollars with tuition dollars, we can't grow. All we're doing is just staying in place. I was able to raise tuition for several years before we started having these drastic cuts. And with the new resources, we were able to do a lot of upgrades and really make our law center more competitive with our counterparts. But, you know, with mid-year budget cuts every year for the last 5 years, it's hard to plan. It's hard to, you know, have some real definition as to how you're going to proceed and get your program to get better. So, you know, right now, only 29% of our budget actually comes from state appropriations, whereas when I came 10 years ago, we were talking about some 71-72% with state dollars. So, you know, I mean, this thing has turned upside down.
Yeah, well, that's a decline of 42%. So that's an amazing change. So, and I would imagine tuition has gone up considerably.
Absolutely. Right now, but we still, even with our tuition having gone up, we're still one of the best bargains mm-hmm. in the country. Our tuition for a full-time day student, Louisiana resident, is roughly around $10,600 for out-of-state.
It's for a year or a semester?
A year. out of state, we're talking about $18,000. And our law school has been cited by, several bodies like U.S. News and World Report as being one of the most best valued law schools in the country, you know, compared to counterparts who have tuition $41,000 mm-hmm. and ours only $10,000, but yet and still our law students taking, passing the bar and competing.
Well, how difficult is it to pass the bar these days?
You know, we are not where we want to be. We had a little glitch in the road this past July because there was a new bar scheme that went into effect, and not only did we drop off, but LSU as well as Loyola and all Tulane fell in that bar passage. Our bar passage for the last six years have been averaging around 65%, but in somewhere after 9 months, we would have roughly 80% of our students by the bar, primarily because at that time you could take the bar a second time on a conditional.
Right.
We can't do that anymore.
Well, congratulations on your success. 10 years on the bluff as Chancellor of the Law Center. Freddie Pitcher, always good to see you.
Jim, thank you so much. Always glad to be here.
My pleasure. We'll return to WRKF.